The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Life is made up of millions of tiny moments. I believe that one of our tasks as humans is to be present for as many of them as possible. When you reflect on the unforgettable events or incredible memories in your life, zoom in and there will be these little moments before or after the event that sit in your heart space. The moment you knew things would never be the same again, the hour you felt the shift, the minute that saved your life or the second that changed it. These are the moments that build movements. Sometimes they are global, and other times they are just the simple first step to change. Join me as I uncover these moments with my inspiring, innovative, and extraordinary guests. My guest today is Joycelyn Longdon, a climate researcher, academic, bookworm, and Gen Z disruptor. As she takes up space in the climate science world, she is grounded in a deep knowledge of her calling. Her reverence for spirituality and respect for Indigenous voices is admirable. Joycelyn is in her first year of a four-year master's and PhD at Cambridge University. She is studying the application of artificial intelligence to climate change. In April 2020, Joycelyn founded Climate in Colour, an online educational platform and community for the climate curious. It stands at the intersection of climate science and social justice and is making the climate conversation more accessible and diverse. I truly believe Joycelyn's vision and calling is so divine. I am excited and honoured to be speaking with her today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm really, really excited to have you on. I first discovered Joycelyn in a creative collective called Black on Black Creatives. Now, a lot of people know you at the moment for Climate in Colour, but I felt discovering you in that collective that was based out of Somerset House, am I right?
Yeah.
And also, would you say collective or agency?
So it sort of evolved over time. It started as, I don't think it ever was a collective. It started sort of as a platforming space, a publication.
Yeah.
And then it moved into sort of the agency realm as time went on. And that's where I sort of ended up at Somerset House.
Yes. And the core values or the reason for this was to connect Black creatives and champion their work and also bring forward thinking brands together to diversify the creative industries. I'm really keen to like highlight to people that you've kind of always been about this work of diversifying, using your voice and your expertise to diversify spaces.
Yeah, I guess it's seeming like a trend right now.
Nice. Well, let's move on to where you're at now with Climate in Colour. For those of you that don't know, Climate in Colour is a platform at the intersection of climate science and social justice, a space for education and sharing knowledge. So, Joycelyn, when did you realise that we really needed this space?
So I think I was never, at the beginning, I wasn't like creating what I thought like everybody needed. I created what I thought I needed. And as someone who was just about to embark on this huge 4 years degree in the climate space that I didn't think that I was going to get onto. It was a huge shock, and I hadn't prepared myself for really how strange I am in this space. And how there's not really much of, or at the time, I didn't really feel like there was much of my voice being mirrored in the academic field per se. And as you mentioned, I've always sort of been in this space of using creativity to diversify spaces. And that's sort of, I guess, what I like go back to each and every time. And I thought, okay, how can I situate myself in this space? What do I feel like is missing? Which is information being basically gatekept by huge institutions like Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And also that information being heavily created by and validated by a homogenous group of people who don't have the experience of all the different types of people around the world. And so it was important for me to create a space where I could share what I was learning for my own benefit in order to understand better where I am situated in this sort of climate space, but also knowing that as someone who loves learning, I don't necessarily think that you should have to go to university in order to know information that is actually quite essential to the decisions you make in your daily life and that have ripple effects on our global community. And so that's really when I just thought, I'm just going to start this page. And I had no sort of ulterior motive with the page. As I was saying earlier, like, I started it in April 2020. And like I was saying to like my friends and my boyfriend, I was like, do you know what, if this gets 500 followers by September, you know, by the time I start my degree, then like, that would be amazing. I really had no, like, literally no
idea.
Motivation.
Yeah.
And I guess we'll talk about this a little bit later, but I really wasn't on social media like that. You know, I never had it as a ambition. I was never envious of people with big platforms. I saw that as something that like I wanted. So like really and truly, I was just creating for creating's sake. I think that that's important. And I think that, yeah, being creative and using different media to communicate points is something that I just enjoy generally. And and I felt like Climate and Colour, at least for me, sort of ticked all these different boxes.
That I was craving.
You've spoken into a couple of things that I think are so important. One is the decision to do something because you wanted to see it, because you wanted to, as opposed to getting into this habit of creating in response to. I think because you answered a call within yourself of what you wanted to see, there was such an authentic flow with what you were doing, and the passion comes across so much. One of the things that I really love about Climate and Colour is that it also feels so inclusive, and you get a sense that there is a joy, there is joy in putting out the information. And it's so lovely to hear that, it's so lovely to hear how it was born. And I think the reason why I sort of highlight that is because social media at the moment is, for a lot of young people, is sucking them in sometimes negative ways. And from the outside, people can think, you know, movements or big followings are born from deciding to get on Instagram because you want followers. And this is valuable information for our younger listeners, that you actually started with the passion first, and you started with really caring about it, and then the incredible achievement of getting into Cambridge. And also, can we have a moment for that? Because I'm proud of you. I felt like your auntie when I read this. I was like, oh, Cambridge. But let's talk about another element that you talked about. This wasn't on previous questions, and feel free, we can move on from it or not. But you talked about being you in that space. And well, there's so much you can unpack there, but I'd like to know a little bit about showing up in Cambridge on the course that you're in, and feeling the process that it is to feel confident and be yourself and continue flourishing in what you do in a space that, you know, let's call it for what it is. It's very white, it's very old school, and has previously been very closed. And also, I know a little bit of your story just from social media about how you got into Cambridge, because you generously have shared that on your, it's on your YouTube, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you can touch on that a little bit about getting in and believing, you know, believing that you could, and then getting in, and then life in Cambridge for a young Black lady.
Yeah. Okay, so this is going to be very, very transparent.
Please do.
So from the outset, and I guess this is important because there will be lots of other people. I get so many questions all the time about my course, and also the way that people sometimes treat me or like speak to me in the way that like I'm an expert and I like know everything. And yeah, I think that what I'm about to say will help people understand like who I am in this space. Mm-hmm. So I graduated from university, my undergraduate, in 2019 summer. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself that I was never going to do higher study. One, because I come from a low-income background and I have lived on my own since I was 17. So finances not there to support myself through higher study. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that I would get a first in my degree. I like basically until I got my undergraduate, I thought I was just, like, stupid, like genuinely thought I was stupid.
Really?
Yeah. That's just like childhood trauma, stuff. African family.
Okay. Yeah.
But I didn't think I'd get to this space. But then I got my first and I was like, you know, let me just browse, let me just see, you know, if there's any funded stuff going on. And like literally the only course that I thought that I would want to do was this course. My undergrad was in astrophysics. I wanted to move away from physics and do something with purpose. I'm a very spiritual person. Mm. And I had been getting a lot of messages. I struggle with mental health as well. And at the time I was getting a lot of messages from God about that I was like going to do something. And it was like really scary. And I was like, wait, like what is going on?
Wow.
And that was the only course. I spent 6 months basically umming and ahhing, not going to apply, you know, the usual, I'm never going to get into Cambridge, I don't want to even go there anyway, you know, all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And my godmother had just got her PhD. Now my godmother had been out of work for 20 years. She was a nurse, and she got back in without having to do a master's to do her PhD because she's that talented, and did her PhD with a husband who's a surgeon, 4 kids, like, you know, the whole shebang. She did
the whole works
and got it. And I spoke to her and, you know, I was like, do I even apply for this? And she was like, I just did it. And, you know, everything was against me in completing that degree. And she said, you know, pick a list of supervisors that you're interested in their work, email them with your credentials. If it's positive, then apply. If it's negative, then don't apply. And the feedback I got back was positive. Mm. And that was such an important thing for me to do. And I'm so grateful that she told me to do that, because right now, one of the people that I emailed back then, which was like, you know, nearly over a year ago, year and a half ago, is my supervisor now.
Oh, yeah, wow. I'll
come back to that later.
Wow, that's such a good full circle. Yeah.
And you know, so I applied. I was still, you know, then it came up to the point where I was taking Back on Black quite seriously and was at Somerset House, as you said. And, you know, I just applied just so that when I'm 50 and I think about what I've done in my life, I don't regret never having applied to a course that I, you know, could have got into. And I got an interview. My interview was terrible. I do talk about this in the YouTube video. I left that interview bawling my eyes out. I was just so embarrassed and mortified. I felt so stupid. It was like awful.
Did you think that you hadn't been your best self, or did you feel that they made you feel like you shouldn't be there?
I feel like I wasn't given the opportunity to show off my passion and my knowledge. I had prepared so much and I'm so passionate about the topic that I want to study. And a lot of the questions, I guess, I found quite patronizing. Mm. I guess I thought they were focusing on things that, like, were obvious, you know, like, do you know that a PhD is hard? Yes, I do. I wouldn't be applying to it if I, you know, didn't understand that. So, yeah, that's everything up until getting in.
Mm.
And I guess a lot of my issue, and I guess this is different because it's lockdown.
Mm.
And so I haven't really experienced Cambridge as Cambridge. I mean, I live here, but I've never been into my building.
Yeah, of course. That,
like, everything has been online. And that poses a whole lot of difficulties that got nothing to do with my race, but have everything to do with academia and just how stressful and, yeah, crazy academia is.
It is, yeah.
I guess in terms of diversity and my passions, it's quite difficult being in a space, the climate space, which, or the climate science space, the tech space, which considers human rights or human involvement or sociology as a complete afterthought, if not irrelevant. And that's a huge struggle to deal with, because you're constantly having to revalidate to yourself why what you want to do is important, whilst all of your teaching sort of goes against that. And I'm, again, coming back to talking about my supervisor, the only thing that really keeps me so grounded and so grateful for being here, this is one of the upsides of going to such a rich and such a prestigious university, is that the academics are first class. And my supervisor, I have a main supervisor and a co-supervisor. My main supervisor is in the technology space and my co-supervisor is in the sociology space, which again is quite a strange thing for the space that I'm in.
Yeah.
And they are both just so amazing. They know more than me. They invite me to webinars and seminars that stretch what even I thought that I could know. I'm learning so much from them. And they are also so behind and so sort of supportive and encouraging of what I want to do, and, you know, are taking all the effort to make sure that I can follow my values, but at the same time still get that across to my department in a way that, like, is valid.
Yeah. Wow. It sounds like, what a blessing to have that support. Yeah. You know, it's little moments like that where it's a supervisor or a teacher or a person that's placed in a way that you realize why they're there, and you can have such appreciation for those moments that make you go, oh my goodness, thank God you're here to carry me through this, or not even carry you through, to be there for you.
For sure
You touched on so much. I'm gonna go back to something that might surprise people from everything you said, because you gave us a wonderful insight, but the part about knowing that you were going to do something, the spiritual element of it, and connecting that as well with depression. I've been thinking recently, I've suffered from depression as well. And I was listening to a podcast and also thinking about the connection that depression has with sort of spirituality and soul work, and how developing a language or naming things differently can help you through particular moments. And I know they're very different things. You know, clinical depression, and some people will need medication or, you know, to see a doctor. And there's also an element of it that I find that feels quite spiritual, as in there's such a discomfort with the soul in the body that you're kind of like, what is this thing I can't shake? And I wondered if you had any thoughts about those connections, and also how you've managed to deal with any kind of periods or cycles of depressed or depression during these studies, which I imagine can be quite stressful.
Yeah. Yeah, this whole episode is just going to be transparency central. So yeah, I was diagnosed with clinical depression in 2015, but I had basically suffered from clinical depression since I was like 10, which is like wild.
Did you feel when you got the diagnosis, you were kind of like, oh, this makes so much sense?
No, I knew it. I knew it already. The only reason I got the diagnosis was because there was like a intense period of like quite intense self-harming thoughts, and like my friends basically wanted me to go and get on medication. So that's like the only reason that I went to get diagnosed. I mean, I knew that I had it before. And then yeah, after diagnosis, I sort of went on medication for like 2 weeks, and then, you know, they gave you the medication and they say, let's see how it works with you. Then 2 weeks later, we'll bring you back in.
Yeah.
And 2 weeks later, they never brought me back in. So,
okay.
So I was like, okay, I don't even like the medication anyway. but yeah, it's so funny because it's like my depression is just me, and that's like what I live with every day. And that's not to say that I like don't have happy moments, but like that is an overwhelming like part of my life, but in the same vein as my spirituality. And it's so hard to describe, but like in a sense, my depression makes me work on myself so much, and makes me like crave and work towards a connection with God so much. And I do a lot to lose control and like give that control to God. And that's why I guess I'm saying that I knew that I was supposed to do something, but like I'm just going wherever God's telling me to go, if that makes sense.
So much.
So like that's what guides anything I do. And again, a lot of my I wouldn't say I'm Christian. I wouldn't say I'm not Christian, but my family are overwhelmingly Christian. And my godmother is always giving me, you know, such amazing insights from her sort of Christian practice and beliefs. And that pushes me on as well. But the spirituality is less so to cure the depression. It's just that this is like what I'm working with, and this is what informs my life. And I think a lot of the time why I end up in these situations doing, you know, Black on Black or Climate and Colour, and you're saying there's all these themes, is because like I'm a huge empath, and I think that empathy loops into my depression, that loops into like what I actually do, because I think that I'm being led there by God. Is this just like sort of cycle of sort of, yeah, I don't know how to explain it.
Well, I feel you. It does. I feel you. And as you're speaking, I get this sense of a deeper understanding of why you're called into this area. You have this intelligence, and I guess a deep understanding of the current state of our world, and an idea or a passion to research what might happen, how we might change and grow. And it makes sense to me when I think about the state of the earth and the planet, and I think about the people most passionate and I'd say desperate to have an awakening so that we might realize the state of things.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me that there is an element of that around you. Not to say that you should be depressed because of what you know, but it reminds me of activism or having a deep love for something and seeing it in such a way that you wish so much everybody could.
Yeah.
And it brings you to this thing of like, oh my God, you have to be in this world, and you have to, you know, be your best self and show up in all these sort of ordinary ways. And then alongside your passion, intelligence and knowledge, you have your heart and your spirit. And so I can totally imagine how that feels. That can feel heavy.
And I guess I can't differentiate between that in my work, because my work is incredibly linked to my spiritual beliefs. So I guess I haven't actually made it clear, but I'm trying to look at applying artificial intelligence to climate change solutions, and within that, centering Indigenous knowledge into algorithms, for many reasons, because
babe, let's have a moment for that. So this is what your master's and PhD at Cambridge is.
My course is AI for ER, so it's artificial intelligence for environmental risk, but that covers everything from renewable energy to climate change to biodiversity. You know, it covers basically everything within the environmental sciences. And for me specifically, I'm in the midst of crafting my PhD proposal. So this isn't like 100% yet, but I'm going to be hopefully looking at forest environments, biodiversity, and how to incorporate Indigenous knowledge into algorithms for more democratic forms of engagement with forests, because there are lots of issues with large-scale conservation and big tech that are, you know, acting in a way that they believe is positive for the planet, you know, on this mass scale, mass planting, mass carbon offset system. And that is causing human rights violations against Indigenous communities who have been caring for this land for millennia, centuries, and it's rightfully their land. And I think that it's important that whilst we're crafting climate solutions, that like we're not pushing human rights to the back burner. And so I'm trying to incorporate, you know, the science and the Indigenous knowledge and the sociology all together into one PhD to essentially hopefully change and disrupt what we see conservation as and what we see technology as and how we prioritize Indigenous knowledge in our climate mitigation strategies.
Girl, you're a gift. You are a gift. I've
done it yet, you know.
The fact that you're articulating it in this way, because, you know, having the thought and being able to bring the idea forward to us, you are enabling us to vision another way of being and also just centering that Indigenous voice with AI. Like even just hearing that in the same sentence for me, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's the thing. I wouldn't have the capabilities to do that, but the fact that you're able to bring these worlds together in the vessel that you're in is, it feels to me, it's just so special. This is why you excite me. Also the timing of your voice, right? We're 2020 was the year that it was, and we also had Black Lives Matter take a more intense turn. And I was saying a lot that the 2020 would be about a clearer vision. And I didn't mean it in a sort of like, just a 2020 vision. I meant really, I meant it as truth. I meant, let this be a period of deep truths. And what you speak to me about in this moment and what you're trying to, you're doing it, what you're uncovering in your research are deep truths. And they're like sacred truths of the land that have to come out. I do think you have a certain energy that is connected to your generation as well. Would you be considered Gen Z?
Yeah, I think I am Gen Z. I'm 1997. So.
Yeah. Oh, nice. I'm so jealous. I mean, you guys have come with such mission and purpose, and I have such admiration for it.
Yeah, I would like to say, like, I talk about this with my boyfriend a lot, and it's like, I just feel like no matter what people have to say, like, in terms of looking around, and maybe there's bias, but I do think that, like, Gen Zers are some of the most compassionate, respectful, creative people that I've ever encountered. And this also comes with, like, how I've had engagements with people in quite difficult conversations, no matter. Like, I know that there are lots of racial tensions at the minute, but like, I'm here like doing workshops with Oxford students, postgraduate students. Everyone is sort of communicating in such a respectful way, but also such a challenging way. And I feel very proud to be part of Gen Z. And I think that like, we have been forced to become these people because there's like not, who else can we push on these issues to? It's on us. And we are sort of stepping up to the plate, I guess.
Yeah, you have, Here's the thing. I think you do what millennials want to do in their heart, but we're kind of too, we're too addicted to or affected by our parents' generation. So we know what you're doing is right, but it's the courage to embody it. And I think Gen Z has come in with this, you're like, we've got nothing left. Yeah. And everything to fight for. Yeah. So whereas like I feel millennials can sometimes have this sort of battle of like ego and you know, I want to look a certain way and I want my life to look like this, Gen Z is like, what are you even talking about? You won't have an earth to live on and you're worried about your mortgage. We're talking about the earth that your mortgage might not exist on. And there's there's a deeper clarity to it, and with the empathy and kindness actually. I've found this to be true. I've been on a few protests where I've met Gen Zers, 19, 20, 22 year olds, and they are first of all communicating with people that they disagree with, and creating space to be heard and listen, but also I guess it's this deeper connection with the earth that feels quite urgent to them. And you have it in your work as well. Another thing with what I enjoy about how you show up in the world is you're putting all the passion into this research and into this knowledge. So you don't necessarily do follow the waves in which activism takes place traditionally. Like people might not see you posting what the masses are posting, but you use your education to come into the conversation with what you know. So I really love that, because there are different ways to be an activist. You can be on the front line and you can also, you know, create the knowledge and do the research. So thank you for that. I really love it.
No worries. No, I definitely agree with that. And I like mainly say that I'm not an activist. I think everyone is an activist in a certain way, but like there are lots of, especially when you have a following on social media, people like to label you without actually like asking you what you identify as. And like, I'm really not an activist if we're going by like what the like usual connotations of an activist is. And I really don't identify with that label at all. But I did a post on Climate in Colour, which was about what's my role in the climate movement. And it was just to describe the fact that there isn't one way to be part of the climate movement. And I'm just sick and tired of people feeling like they have to change in order to join the climate movement, where it's like, we're all in the climate movement. We are all citizens of this earth. Mm-hmm. And we're all already doing things that can be applied and create change. If you're a musician, if you're an artist, if you're a filmographer, if you're a healer, if you're a mother, if you're a cleaner, if you're a teacher, if you're a lawyer, if you're a tribal leader, you know, every person come with what you already have. And I'm coming with what I have, which is academia and creativity. I'm not about trends. I already told you I didn't join this space with any intention. I'm not the news, I'm not any other influencer, I don't even see myself as an influencer. I'm literally an academic, and I'm just trying to share the things that I'm learning and to sort of fill that value system and calling that I was talking about at the beginning of this episode. And I like just want people to respect that, and I think people are really respecting that. And this year I'm having a much better time on social media by basically not really being on it, but being on it.
Yeah, well, let's get into that actually, because this is another great thing that you've done. You are really clear on your boundaries, and it seems like you've got a really nice team around you as well. Obviously, it gets being a full-time student and then having to deal with a platform that will have lots of inquiries and collaborations. What is clear is that you know who you are. And you say what you can manage and what you can't. And you also talk about not really being on Insta that much. Can you talk a bit about how you learn about what boundaries you had to set, whether it was a bit of a process, and also team building as well? Because I think that's a really important thing for growth. And it feels like you knew this quite quickly.
Yeah, so a few ways to answer this question. I think, first of all, I was quite lucky in the fact that when I graduated, I worked both professionally and not professionally, but sort of like as an employee and as a freelancer in the sort of marketing, design, web, social media space. And so I already knew about social media, and I already knew about social media in a very like business focused way rather mm-hmm. than like a personal way. And so I already had that experience of managing a page as a business,
right?
As an individual.
Yeah.
And that's why I didn't use my personal account, because as a person, as Joycelyn, I didn't post that much. I posted for the first time since November last week on my personal account. Like, I'm not on Instagram like that. And I've done that since sort of school times, because it's bad for my mental health. And not for any reason. I mean, I've done a lot of sort of shadow work on envy, and I don't really have that anymore. Like, I don't go on and see like a beautiful woman and think, oh my gosh, I'm so ugly, or I don't, you know, that's like not really part of my social media experience. And for the most part, I don't go on social media because I love reading, I love painting, I love walking, I like doing things. And that is not conducive with a life on social media, which is why just as Joycelyn, wasn't my vibe. And so obviously I didn't know that Climate and Colour was going to grow to the size that it did. And another thing is that like people only see the Instagram side, but like I'm creating courses, workshops, I have an online community, an online reading group, I'm doing talks, podcasts, like writing essays, getting published in academic journals. Like, there is so much that's going on off of Instagram, which is like, I don't think people get, like, everyone's so addicted to Instagram, but they think the whole world exists on Instagram. it's just like, it doesn't make sense to me. And I also started to feel, because you asked whether it was a process, and I guess it was a process, because I couldn't understand why everyone was asking so much of me on Instagram. And I couldn't understand how a page that positions itself as an education page has so many demands that are expecting it to be a news site. And there are news sites, there are climate news sites, not even mainstream news, but I would constantly share the sources that I read for climate news and people who are speaking on climate issues. And I did get caught up in it for a little bit. Because you see everyone's posting all the time and you think, oh my gosh, like, am I supposed, is that what this means? And I've always been very self-assured, and I was just thinking, wait, no, this isn't, this in my bio, it says what I am. It says education platform. So I'm just going to continue doing what I said I am. So like, I don't know what people think doing a PhD is like. Like, I don't know what people's concept of doing a PhD, being a human, having a relationship, having family, all of that, plus climate and colour, looks like. And I think it's because when things are on Instagram, people just think you're an influencer. And Climate Colour is a business. It's not an influencing thing. I have a team of 10 employees. Like, it's not just a page. And I remember before Christmas, like, telling someone that I had burnt out and that I was going to go off for a month or whatever. And they were like, oh, really? But, and I said, like, you know, I've had a really hard term. It's been really stressful. So I need to take a break. And they were like, oh, really? But don't you have a team? I was like, wait, what do you think that means? Like, what do you think? I like do nothing, and my like who runs the team? And so I think after that, I was just like, boy, people just actually don't know what they're talking about. Let me just carry on with what I want to do, and people can, you know, they can leave if they want to. That's fine. I need to put my studies first, also all the things I love first. Like, I love reading, and I'm so happy that this year I've got, just got so much back into my reading. I am a real bookworm, and I'm
And there was a wonderful space that you made just to talk about boundaries that you made a point of putting on the page, and I thought it was great to see that, but also a good lesson for other people. You know, it's perfectly fine and in fact encouraged to set your boundaries and say what you can take. And it was very honest and transparent. And I think that was wonderful to read. So yeah, it's wonderful to see and hear as well that you have those priorities in place, because it's easy to get lost in it.
Yeah, and I think I really do worry for people who don't have that in place, because like Instagram is an app. Like it's an app, and I think it's wonderful in so many ways. Obviously, I'm a beneficiary of the app. But I just worry that we're getting a skewed idea of what the world is and like what interacting with other humans is, and also of like what our own lives are.
Yeah.
But it's like virtual reality almost. And I think as well, a lot of harm that I see happen, and obviously I'm part of this, is that there were people who have been working in the climate space for decades, who have been speaking on these topics for decades, but because they don't have social currency is now the new capitalism. And I spoke about this in a post as well, like I'm not going to be adding to the noise in the climate space. Just because we're in the climate space doesn't mean we're all good. Doesn't mean that every action we do is positive. And we do need to hold ourselves to account that although the intention is there, we are doing the exact same thing as capitalism is. We say we don't like infinite growth, but what are we doing? We're constantly posting. We say we don't like the things that capitalism instilled, but we are just sort of copying that in the climate space. This sense of urgency, the sense of scarcity, those are all philosophies of capitalism. I think, how are you showing up outside of those spaces? It's not to say that they're not important, but I think that it gets to a point sometimes where it's like really unhealthy, and where I would literally be spending 12 hours researching, studying, reading, crying over climate science,
and
then someone will DM me and reproach me for not posting about something. Like, what do you think I'm doing? Like, what do you actually think?
How are
you doing?
Oh, wow. Wow.
So I think we need to like understand and be more compassionate, which is why I want Climate and Colour to be a quite joyful place, because I think compassion is important, and I don't subscribe to being sort of angry, doomsday seeking.
Yeah, it never feels like that on the platform. I feel like I'm getting the facts about what's happening, but it doesn't feel like, yeah, it doesn't feel doomsday, but it feels like this is the reality that you need to understand and know. It's important to have that in the mix.
Because I just think, and I think that anyone who's feeling down in the dump should read Hope in the Dark by Rebecca Solnit, because that is exactly my vibe. It's like, what is the point in being doomsday and making people burn out? Either they go one way, which is there's no point, we shouldn't do anything, we're screwed, or like are just invested in the doom. And that doesn't, I'm interested in imagination. I'm interested in sort of dreaming up futures. I'm interested in exploring different knowledge systems, exploring how we can work together as a community to create futures, plural, because we all have different ideas about what the future should look like. And I don't really believe in a sort of homogenous utopian ideal, but I think that's what I want to encourage on my page, and that's what I want to speak about. And there are lots of other spaces that offer other things that are different, and people can go to those places if they want.
exactly. On the point of when you just said Hope in the Dark and you know, your real life that you prioritize, what kind of things do you do to unwind, to plug out? I think I said this to you earlier, like I just imagine you loving nature and having you know the most amount of joy with a book in a field. But is that the case? And is looking at nature or being in nature a chance for you to sort of, I guess, understand more of what you do and what you love?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even feel like it's looking in nature. It's really like submerging myself in nature.
Yeah, that's the word, actually.
Yeah, I just feel like I'm home when I'm in nature. I just feel so... that. So when I'm talking about, like, being on Instagram and, like, do people know what's going on in the real world, then, like, I also apply that to myself doing my degree, and then I go outside into nature and I'm like, wait, no, this is the real world, you know, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah,
you know, I'm so, so lucky to live where I live now in Cambridge. Like, I can see the woods, and the bird song here is just insane. It's aww, just amazing, and it brings me so much joy. But even where I grew up, I grew up in a council flat, but we had, like, a brook behind the house, there were lots of fields. Yeah, even though it was London, I grew up sort of adjacent to a lot of very, like, white middle class areas, so that was a privilege in itself. Even though I grew up low income, I sort of had access to fields and canals and woods and all of that good stuff. So I've always felt like that's been around me. And my boyfriend is from Cornwall, and I've spent a lot of time in Cornwall. I will probably settle in Cornwall. Even though I'm a city girl, I like, the country is literally where I feel at home.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, and that is exactly how I relax. But it's not really relaxed. It's a very active engagement when I'm in nature. It's not just relaxing. Like, to relax, I might paint or I might read. But, like, when I'm out in nature, it's sort of like communing with God. And so, like, part of my spiritual practice, I, like, read some spiritual texts from different religions. And I'm currently reading the Dhammapada, and in my last sort of session, it was just talking about how, like, beauty is truth and nature is beauty, so hence nature is truth and nature is God. And I was just like, that is how I feel about nature. And I guess it's like going to church for me is nature.
Your spiritual foundation, and that I'm learning about in this conversation, is my favorite thing. Just knowing that you have this exploration of the sort of awareness of spirit and how it's part of and the foundation of how you're moving in the world and how you're showing up. How has that deepened or changed in recent years? Is it something that you've always had? You have talked about your Christian family, but in terms of finding your own voice, your own spiritual voice, I guess, or path. And you talked about shadow work as well, that I'm very interested in.
Yeah. So I've probably been, when I moved out when I was 17, that was probably like the end of my, like, strictly Christian sort of experience. And so that was 6 years ago? So I guess I've been on this sort of journey of finding my spiritual voice for about 6 years. And it ebbs and flows. I wouldn't say right now I'm at my strongest. I think the strongest I was at was after my graduation. Wow, I was just so in tune with everything that was going on. So it ebbs and flows. Sort of at this point, a lot about learning. And I was saying earlier to my boyfriend that, like, after this PhD is done, I'm gonna look back and be like, wow, what just happened? Because I, like, grow so much every single day, and I'm challenged so, so much, and my spirit is challenged so much. It might be the stress of doing a PhD, but it also, I think, is a consequence of coming to Cambridge, that I do have a breakdown once a week. And that is like a sort of, it's just like a switch. Like, the week's really busy, you do the week, then you're on the weekend really tired and exhausted, and then you break down trying to recover from that week so that you can, like, go into the next week. And, like, that's the routine.
When you say breakdown, what does that look? Is that just like a complete wipeout? You're lying in bed, can't move? Or
no, that's a very emotional release of
okay.
of tears, worry and anxiety, and, you know, oh my gosh, I can't do this, I'm useless, I'm not adding anything to the world, you know, just complete spiraling of thoughts, and then sort of getting over it.
And then finding yourself. So do you do any kind of like meditations or yogas or is there time for that? No. Yeah.
Oh, I make time for that. I wake up really early. So I have like 2 hours in the morning, most mornings, to do meditation, yoga. So I do yoga probably five-ish times a week, maybe more if I want to. And I maybe meditate and journal like 3 to 4 times a week.
Yeah.
Because I don't see those as like activities. They're like, they have to be a part of
being.
Yeah. And so that's the time that I like will read my books, like not my leisure books, like my more like spiritual teaching books, yoga and meditate, and journal. And when I'm journaling, I'm really just talking to myself and atting myself and kind of communicate what's going on in my head.
I'm so happy that you have created that space, and I completely agree and relate with the practices not being something that are negotiable. You know, there are some, if you're have any mental health issues or depression, in my case, my meditation is completely non-negotiable. My morning walk is non-negotiable. These are the things that just they have
it's
to
like
happen.
Brushing your teeth.
I
wouldn't leave my house without brushing my teeth. I can't start my day without, you know, having a moment for my spirituality, even if I'm very pushed or I've woken up late. Like, it has to happen.
Oh gosh. Okay. Well, we have to, I don't want to finish this conversation, but I've got your email now. So I'm going to be like being like, can I have a chat with you? I've got a few more questions I'd like to ask. Yeah. So this will be coming out in the week of International Women's Day. Mm. And this season has featured some of my favorite women, yourself included, across the arts. So we've got Janelle, who is a yogi and has done great work for making the yoga spaces more inclusive. Shingi Shonua, who is a wonderful British singer, songwriter, artist. And the three of you have shown up in this world to me in your true selves, and in little and big ways, you've stepped into your light, and I just find you all very luminous. So you're my woman of the month. And I would like to know if there is any women that have inspired you to do what you do, or
The two main women would be my godmother and my mother. They are both, just incredible women that have such strength. Like, the way in which they deal with problems that come up, which are plenty, and the way that the faith that they have in God and the positivity that they approach life when they shouldn't, when they should be completely and utterly frustrated or upset, is really inspiring and is making me, makes me all the time push to be more conscious of, all the privileges I have on account of them. Those are the two women, probably two people I care about the most.
Yeah.
In terms of like what they think about me, or, I'm representing them, so those would be.
I love that. Close to home. And then my final question is, I'd love to know a bit about what your hopes are for the future. I know it probably feels like a long way away now after the PhD, but also just maybe your vision for how you'd like the world to move. Maybe an ideal, maybe it's kind of a bit more, it might feel like a dream, but something that you think is maybe possible and that you'd like to see, or something you want to work towards or make happen through the work you do.
Yeah, I think I'll keep this quite specific, because in the climate space, I think most people agree that we can flip from being really ideological to like being like, oh my gosh, this is never going to happen. And we all sort of know the things that we want to come true, renewable energy, etc. So I'll be more specific to like my space. And I guess my sort of hope is that I am sort of successful in disrupting the technology space, and in showing and being an example for how to do equitable sort of decolonial work with communities that are really important, and to platform and to give voice to people. I hope that there's a future where storytelling is a important part and a sort of central part of our lives, and that we become a more empathetic society that cares about our communities, global and local.
Mm.
And I sort of want, I hope that there's going to be a future where everyone can self-determine the future that they want. Again, like, I don't believe in a homogenous utopia, but I hope that there's a world where someone in Ecuador can equally determine their life as someone in Ghana can equally determine their life and future as someone in London, and that all those people can be provided with the necessities, the human rights that they deserve, and live in the ways that they see best for their communities. I think that's really important to me, and I think that that's something that we haven't as of yet achieved. I don't think that, whether we're talking about rich countries, there's no self-determination. Poorer countries, there's no self-determination. We think we got self-determination here in the UK and the US and the EU, but we don't really have self-determination. And I think, and I guess that's my hope for the future, self-determined futures that are based on equity and community and sort of compassion.
Oh, wow, that was music to my ears. Thank you so much. Really, you are such an incredible soul. It's been such an honor to speak to you. I'm so excited about what you're going to do and how you're showing up. And you really feel like the embodiment of what so many of us have been calling for. And without putting pressure on you, you know, and that entire community is listening to you. There's something about the way you're doing what you're doing that just feels really luminous and special. And also your humility. You're so humble and kind and compassionate, which means a lot to you. And it is just so, so wonderful to be around. So I am going to be rooting for you all the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
And I'm going to be following along. Oh, I did want to add, if anyone is interested in going a bit deeper or learning with Climate in Colour, you offer a course, don't you? The Colonial History of Climate. Do you want to talk a little bit about it? They can go on the website, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I'll just speak really quickly about it. The Colonial History of Climate is a course that it's an introductory course. It's about an hour of content on the website, but it's broken up into modules, and it has sort of integrated prompts in it to sort of give a backdrop to how our current climate emergency is based off of colonialism and how climate influenced colonialism, and to give a backdrop as to how we sort of should go forward in terms of combating these systems within our solutions going forward. But that's not the only way that people can engage if they want to learn a little bit more. There is the Climate in Colour community, which you like can subscribe to through Patreon, but it's hosted on a different platform called Circle. And we have like a monthly reading group for people who are like daunted by academic papers, but really want to know what's going on in academic
papers. Oh, yes, yes. That's great.
Yeah. So I like basically provide the academic paper highlighted with, and then I provide a document with all like a whole summary in case you can't read or don't want to read the academic paper, as well as an audio version of the academic paper, so that everyone can access it. And then we have a monthly discussion where we talk about the topics and the issues in the paper. And we also market on accessibility to sort of see where academics are going right and going wrong. And that's just a space to like dive deeper into what's going on in climate science, but also like in ecology and conservation and environmental justice, a little bit deeper. So yeah. Oh,
amazing. So many resources, so much to offer. And there you are. This is what I mean, showing up in the world. it's such a great joy. Thank you so much. Thank you everyone for listening. As we've said,
thanks for having me.
No, thank you so much. And yeah, you can find out more about Jocelyn via Climate in Colour. Go on the Instagram or the website, where there's a plethora of information. And as Jocelyn has just shared, thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.